What it's actually the real meaning of the word, as far as our meditation is concerned, is the ability to know what's happening, to be aware. Now, you can't be aware of everything because there's too much stuff going on. So, in other words, you put your awareness on what is the most important thing happening right now. So, right now, you are aware, I hope, of what I'm saying. You're not aware of the smells of the unwashed people in this room because we... doesn't matter, we can get some incense out tomorrow if we haven't got any. So you put your awareness on what's most important, which in this particular case is the talk. And as you develop that awareness, and I'll talk about how that's developed in meditation, the awareness gets stronger and stronger and stronger, so you can literally see more. It's the difference between before we put the lights on in this room. Yeah, you could see people, but you couldn't see it in great detail. The light was very dull. When you put the lights up, you can see things very clearly. That's like low mindfulness and high mindfulness. And part of what we're doing on this retreat is to make the quality of mindfulness stronger and stronger and stronger, so you become more aware of what's actually going on, especially what's going on inside your body and your mind. So with that increase in awareness, you find you can get much deeper in meditation. You can understand much more of what's going on inside of you because it's like turning up the lights inside. So mindfulness is basically the ability to be aware and strengthening that awareness so you can see more of what's going on. You can taste more of what's in the food. You can see more of what's on the ground. You can feel more. And mostly you can know much more. But there is a connection between recollection or memory, because you will find if you pay attention to something, you can remember it very easily. The more you pay attention to something, the more it's imprinted on your brain. Or as neuroscientists tell me, that when you are very mindful of what's happening, the neurons fire. And when they fire together, they wire together, as the saying goes. In other words, when you're aware of something, it actually creates pathways in the brain that is called memory. So every time you are aware, you do tend to reinforce that ability called memory. So that's why during this retreat, you become aware, but you'll also remember much more what you're supposed to be doing, where things are, and you won't get so, forgetful. So it's just natural what happens. So there is a very strong connection between mindfulness and memory. And if any of you have got any kids, you tell them to strengthen your mindfulness through meditation. And when you go to school, it's much easier to get good grades. You only have to read the book once. You only have to listen to the lecture once. It sticks inside the brain because you are paying full attention when the teacher's telling you something. And that awareness, that mindfulness, increases your ability to learn. So it's really helpful for any people who have kids having a hard time at school or university. Train the mind in meditation, especially in mindfulness, and your ability to recall the important information increases. Dear Ajahn, I have been sick for a while. How to use what we learn from meditation to cure illnesses? Or should I be so content that I shouldn't try to recover and just let it be? Exactly. Just let it be and then you recover. If you try to get better, then you get worse. So remember, a lot of the sicknesses are because of stress, working too hard, tiring yourself out. So if you want to overcome those sicknesses, number one, accept them. Stop fighting them. And if you stop fighting it and just relax and let your sickness be, it usually doesn't last that long. The more you fight, the more stress you make, and then the illness starts more and more and more. So with the illnesses, just relax and let it be. Follow the instructions of this retreat and you will get much, much healthier. There are so many stories. I'm going to tell two stories now of how meditation saves your life. Literally. One guy, Sydney retreat some years ago. I think it was the same retreat which that executive came on. But this guy, after one or two days, I had all these questions in my box, complaining. They say, can you please tell people to breathe quietly in the meditation hall? Because this guy was making a loud noise all the time. So I answered a question by saying, that gentleman is dying of nasal cancer. He's got a huge tumor in his nose. The doctors have given up on him. And this is the last throw of the dice, as they say, to see if meditation can keep him alive. And as soon as I told people why this man was making a noise, there were no more complaints, but a lot of compassion. What a wonderful thing it was, this guy was giving meditation a chance. He was making that noise because he just could not breathe through his nose. There's a big tumor up there. And the last day, just before I left, he wanted an emergency interview. And he said the last couple of hours, an amazing thing happened. He said he was meditating there the usual way, breathing through his mouth. He heard a pop. That's exactly what he said, a pop. And he could breathe through his nose. But it only lasted about a minute and the tumor closed up again. When he said that, I thought, you left it a bit late. If you'd have started meditating earlier, you could have probably, got that tumor into remission. But he never followed my advice. He just carried on meditating. Because I saw him about 2 or 3 years later. When this guy came up to me in Sydney and said, do you remember me? Please don't say that to a monk. We see so many people and we can't lie. We're going to tell the truth. Yeah, I don't know who you are. And upset you. But it was this guy. He said, I was that guy. And I remembered him once he told me. And he said, I carried on meditating. The tumor shrunk completely away. Full remission. And I'm spending the rest of my life now teaching meditation to others. There was a guy who was on the... basically dying. Nothing more the doctors would do. Huge tumor in his nose. The meditation, it went away. One of the other great stories was so obvious at a retreat which I gave in our previous center in North Perth. We used to hire a place. And I always remember this guy came onto the retreat. Some of you may remember him because you've been coming on these retreats a long time. He came in a rubber face mask. And he checked in with me first of all, maybe Bianca remembers him, checked in with me to say, I'm not sure if I can last the full 9 days. Because he had this eczema, this rash all over his body, psoriasis, that's what it's called. And he said it was all over his body, itches like hell. And he's got the face mask on him, a rubber mask to stop him scratching the skin off his face. He says, in constant torture, having a rash. And he showed me, he lifted up his shirt, pulled up his trousers, and it was right over his whole body. And it looked gross. It's one of the most gross things I've seen. And he stayed the whole 9 days. I was really impressed with him. He said, I may not last even an hour or two, but he stayed 9 days. And when he came to check up with me at the end, he lifted up his shirt. No, he wasn't wearing his face mask. Pulled up his trousers. It had all gone except for a small band around his ankles, maybe 1 or 2 inches wide. He said, look what's happened to me. He said, I've only got this tiny bit. This is nothing. For other people, you'd probably be upset, but this is nothing. Thank you so much. And there was a sickness you could see beforehand and you could see afterwards. Totally clear skin. And the relief on his face was wonderful to see. Taking him out of constant torture, 24 hours torture, and now he was free of this. So yeah, this meditation does work. But you just have to relax, let go, put down the glass, be still, and stop trying to control things. Certainly, if you meditate to get rid of the illness, it won't go. If you meditate just to make peace, to be still, to be kind, then it will go. That's why many doctors send their patients to, you know, meditate in our center. In the morning, you encouraged us to write our bad stories in brown color. The brown color was associated with shit. Why do monks accept brown robes? Exactly. That's why no girls will get interested in us and no guys will get interested in the nuns. They take one look at us and it's associated with us. And I think it was this monk next to me. He sent me an email some weeks ago that when the Australian government initiated plain packaging for cigarettes. You know, the cigarettes, they can't have any logos or advertising. It's plain packaging. But they wanted a colour on the outside of the cigarette packets. And they did psychology research to get the most unattractive colour. And you know the colour they came up with? It's actually a little bit greener. It's like they called it baby poo colour. And that's on cigarette packages today, the plain cigarette packaging. So that's actually these colours, these are much browner colours, but that is the colour of the robes at Ajahn Chah's monastery. It's baby poo brown. You look at those robes they have there, and that's exactly the colour on Australia cigarettes. So yeah, there's an association there. The association, this is not really an attractive colour. But it's very natural. So many things in nature are brown. You know, leaves, dirt, and again shit. But it's just sort of a natural colour. It doesn't excite the senses like bright reds or sort of greens or pinks or something. So this is interesting why this is a nice colour for monks. You know, you're not really attractive anymore. Please can you ask the retreatants to kindly not leave bathroom fans running all day. They are noisy and disturb the others. Beautiful peace, which is such a rare privilege. Okay, this is the first of the complaints about noise. It's so difficult to have a retreat centre where there's no noise at all. I suppose we could put you all in padded cells so that you can't make any noise and no one could hear you. But there's always some noise around. So please try your best, number one, not to bang doors. Number two, not to make a cup of tea at 2 o'clock in the morning, boiling, boiling, clang, clang, clang. You can have a cup of tea, but if you want one in the middle of the night, go down to the kitchen and make one there where the only things you disturb are the ghosts. So you don't need, because if you do it if you really need some hot water in the middle of the night, just try and find a thermos somewhere and put it in there, because if you make a cup of tea, you know, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, it really wakes people up. Because, you know, the kettles, even though they're supposed to be quiet kettles, they still make noise. And dingle, 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 you know, just stirring up the coffee or whatever. So try and do it as quietly as you possibly can. And again, the fans in the room. Little things, only a small thing, but they can be so irritating to you. So try and be as calm and quiet as you possibly can, especially during the sleep periods. And if you can, even coming in here and going out again, try and be as quiet as you can when you come in and out of this room. And if you want to know how to do that, please imagine you are a burglar. A burglar, you know, they're not great meditators, but a burglar can come in and out of a person's house without making any sound at all. And people, they just cannot hear you. So imagine you're a burglar when you come into this room. So you make any noise and somebody will know you're coming in, call the police and you go to jail. When you go into your room at night, imagine you're a burglar, so you open the doors very quietly and you close them very quietly. It reminds me of the story of the drug man who went to the police station late at night. And he went to the police station, he said, "Have you got any thieves, any burglars in the police station tonight?" He said, "Yes, we have. Can I please speak to one of them?" "You can't just speak to a burglar, they've got to go to trial tomorrow." "No, just for half an hour." "Why do you want to speak to a burglar for?" "Look," he said, "I'm late coming home. I'm going to try and sneak into my house without my wife finding out. I want a burglar to give me some advice." So, see if you can sneak in and out of your room as if no one can hear you. Sneak in and out of here so you don't need to disturb. It can be done. Burglars do it. And you're smarter than the burglar. So see if you can be someone who makes hardly any noise at all. So as long as people are trying, it's the best. You'll always make some noise by mistake. But, you know, that just is par for the course. So don't be too critical. Everyone is trying their best. I have read that anatta means non-self. Does that mean that whatever I am experiencing is not mine, or that I don't have a self, or that things don't have selves? I know abiding substance. Of course it means that. But to understand non-self is a difficult thing. Instead of trying to think about it, you won't get anywhere thinking about it. Just get yourselves confused. Instead of thinking about it, we experience it later on in the meditation. But just as a guiding principle, think of just a stream of water, a river. You look at a river and it seems the same every day, just like when you cross the Swan River, it might look the same, but you know the water you're looking at today is totally different from the water you see yesterday. So it looks the same, say crossing the River Swan, but it's totally different. Now that's a good simile of the stream of consciousness. What you take to be yourself, yeah, it looks the same, but if you examine it more closely, what you're looking at today is totally different than what you were looking at yesterday. So this is what we mean by non-self. That thing which you call a self is changing all the time. So what it was yesterday is totally different than what it is today. And there's nothing in there yesterday which remains in there today. But you will find out later on during this retreat. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you please explain how to do walking meditation? When doing breath meditation, we keep our consciousness on breath. Where do we keep the consciousness in walking meditation? Is the left foot and right foot? Yes, one of those two, but not at the same time. So just do on your left foot or on your right foot, and just to do the walking meditation. So first of all, in walking meditation, get into the present moment just now. Secondly, be silent. Thirdly, put your attention on which foot is moving. And then fourthly, full awareness, which means from the very beginning of a left foot moving right to the end of the left foot moving, very beginning of the right foot moving to the end of the right foot moving. So you have full awareness of all of the walking there. So just walking, all the feelings in the legs and on the feet associated with walking, you pick every one of those up. So you're really just aware of walking and nothing else as you walk backwards and forwards. But I'll give more information on that later on. But when I was in Malaysia just over the Christmas period, people were getting a bit bored with just sitting down, watching their breath or doing walking meditation. So I said that we should, sometimes this Buddhism, we have to adapt it to the countries in which we're in. So I encourage people to do the Australian walking meditation method, which is based on kangaroos. So you start at one end of the path
and you put your hands like this, and you don't walk from one end to the other, you hop, 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 hop. When you get to the other end, you turn around and you hop back. It's Australian walking meditation, like a kangaroo. And I ask every one of you, without exception, to try it. At the very least, it will make anybody watching you burst out laughing. And it will make you happy too. And that will make meditation not so damn serious, and have some fun, for goodness sake. So please try kangaroo hopping meditation as a part to show you that Buddhism has now come to Australia. I expect you to try that. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I know we should accept the past and learn to let go of the unpleasant past, but sometimes I'll be reminded of such unpleasant past that has traumatized me before. I know I should learn to accept the past, but how do I do that in meditation? How do I know that I'm successful and allow myself to let go of the past? How you know you're successful is when it just doesn't bug you anymore. In other words, is that just something which happened in the past? Big deal, I've let it go. It's not important anymore. The only reason why it comes up bugging you is because you give it importance. Somehow or other you think, I should really deal with this. It's important. I'm not allowed to let it go. I have to keep punishing myself again and again and again. And sometimes that is the tendency in Western culture, which has infected the East as well, is to think you really deserve punishment. You deserve to be blamed. You deserve to suffer because of some things which you did. Or amazing, people think they should suffer because, you know, you didn't do anything, but somehow or other you deserve to suffer. Just like the idea of original sin, you know, in Christianity. Just because, you know, some woman, Eve, all she did was offer her husband an apple. What's wrong with that? And because of that, women ever since have had to suffer. And she wasn't even a Buddhist. She was a Christian. So nothing to do with us. But still, people think they should suffer because of it. And that, somehow or other, we always think from that time on, we've done something wrong, therefore we must suffer. And that is absolute craziness as far as Buddhism is concerned. If you've done something wrong, you don't get punished. When you do something wrong in Buddhism, you tell everybody about it. It makes them laugh. You know, you did a stupid thing. So that really makes people laugh when you sort of say all the stupid things you've done in your life. And so because of that, there's no punishment. We acknowledge. When there's punishment, it hides the truth. We don't want to admit what we've done because we think we're going to get hurt. You acknowledge it. Yeah, I made a mistake. I did something stupid. And then forgiving means, no, I just par for the course. Everyone make mistakes. And then learn from it. We learn from it to make sure we don't make the same mistake again. And that's all we do. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. No punishment. And when there's no punishment there, it makes it so much easier to let go of things. But when you think there's punishment involved, that makes it so complicated. We don't want to deal with it because we think it's going to hurt. We don't think we should let it go because that's just avoiding punishment which we deserve. No, please, understand, no punishment. No punishment, no punishment, no punishment. And then it's very easy to let go of the past. Acknowledge it, forgive it, and learn. But don't take it on board and hurt yourself. You don't deserve that. Ajahn, can you please tell us why we have such ridiculous thoughts going through our mind? During this afternoon sit, I reminded myself to wash the shirt that I've been wearing all day. Then I caught myself thinking whether I should hang it on the line at the shoulder seams or upside down or over the line folded in half. I mean, really, it's bad enough being bombarded with reasonable thoughts, but ridiculous thoughts, why? The reason is when you run out of reasonable thoughts, there's no more reasonable thoughts to think, then you go to the stupid thoughts. Any thought will do. In the same way, if you're really bored
you look at the TV, and you look at all the interesting programs first of all. If there's nothing interesting on TV, even the boring, stupid stuff, you will still watch anything just to fill up the gaps. So that's what happens. Anything to do, even the most stupid thoughts. So because of that, this is par for the course. After a while, you can value stillness. You realize I don't need to think anything at all. And when you do experience some stillness, please don't be afraid of the stillness. I know for many people, you're outside of your comfort zone in silence. You're so used to thinking, and you got very good at thinking, that you know thoughts, you know that's your usual place you hang out. But no thoughts, that's weird. You're not really quite sure what you should be doing when there's no thoughts going on in the head. So that's why you make some thoughts up. It makes you feel, well, at least this is where I'm used to. It's the same as when a person's been released from prison. They don't know how to relate to life outside. Inside jail, yeah, they know how the system works. They're comfortable inside jail. But leaving jail, that's weird. So in the silence, you're leaving the prison of thoughts. It's weird at first, but just relax into the silence. Don't be afraid. You soon get used to it, and you find you don't have to waste your time on stupid thoughts. It's the same. After a while, you learn to enjoy your house just as it is. You don't have to waste time watching stupid TV shows. Instead, one can just be silent and use your time more wisely. So it's just a case that when profound thoughts, you've got no more profound thoughts to think about, then stupid thoughts and then ridiculous thoughts. Any thought will do. I've read in the Ajahn Chah books that on the road to Nibbana, 1 minute the kalesas dominate, the next the Eightfold Path. Yet I've also heard that one must suppress the kalesas so they don't arise at all. These two seem in conflict. No, you just be careful of Ajahn Chah books. Because I live with Ajahn Chah. And when I read those books, I say, you know, who said this? And it says on the cover, Ajahn Chah. I said, I've never heard that before. A lot of times when people write an Ajahn Chah book, their translators, and maybe 60-70% is a translator, and only 30-40% is what Ajahn Chah actually said. It's been interpreted through the translators. That's why when I read some of this stuff, Ajahn Chah never said that. But they write that down. So on the road to Nibbana, the defilements are the ones which have to be restrained. He was always saying that. So yes, sometimes they come up, but you restrain them. You use skillful means to let go. The defilements are greed, hatred and delusion. You find ways of overcoming them. Yeah, they come up again, but then you overcome them. You weaken them and weaken them until eventually you can overcome them. So there's no real conflict there, not with my memories of Ajahn Chah. And I was with Ajahn Chah for 9 years. I don't think there's only one or two Western monks who was with him longer. Could you please explain why are we bowing 3 times at the end of your talks and the meaning of chanting at the lunch offerings? Thank you very much. The reason why you bow 3 times is because the food here is so delicious and there's so much of it. We do need to exercise our stomach, otherwise you'll put on weight. So the more you eat, the more you have to bow, because that is the only thing which exercises your stomach muscles. It's very, very good to keep you thin. So that's what you're bowing for, to stop you getting fat. So if you feel you are putting on weight, please bow some more. 3 times is not enough. Do 6 or 7. Okay? Now that's a funny story, but the truth of the matter is, when I bow to a Buddha, I even said this in Korea. When I bow to a Buddha, the first time I put my head down, I'm bowing to what the Buddha represents to me, which is, first of all, virtue. I'm bowing to virtue. Because virtue, goodness, trustworthiness is really important to me in my life. I love living with virtuous people. No, you can't get more virtuous than monks and anagarikas, nuns. These are really, really good, trustworthy people. So I really worship virtue. That's when I first bow down, I worship virtue. And I remember virtue when I bow down. Second time I bow down to peace. Peace in my heart, in meditation, peace in the community, peace in the world. Peace is something I find it very easy to worship. And lastly, I bow down to compassion, to kindness. Every time I see an act of kindness, an act of compassion, it just brightens up the world. And it creates so much happiness and joy and hope in this world. So I usually bow down to those three things, virtue, peace and compassion. Which means every time I bow down, I remember those things. I remember their importance. It's just like jogging my memory. Ajahn Brahm, virtue is really important. I bow down to it. Peace is really important. I bow down to that. Compassion is gorgeous. I worship it. I bow down to that. So every time I bow down, I'm remembering and reinforcing the importance of virtue, peace and compassion. So if you want to do the same, I encourage you to do that. If there are three other qualities which you really venerate, then remember those when you're bowing down. And that's a beautiful way to reinforce those qualities so they grow in you more and more and more. Is it okay to walk over to Bodhinyana Monastery once in a while to meditate? Any hours where it is not appropriate? Any etiquette to follow? Thanks. Yeah, that's very allowable. Many people do that. You can walk over to the monastery on the other side of the road and you can meditate in the hall. It's a very good place to meditate. It's got a lot of good energy. And number two, if you don't like the food over here, you can walk over there at 10:30. Find out what's on the menu today. If you don't fancy it, walk over to Bodhinyana Monastery. There's more food over there. And if you're not a vegetarian, if you're fed up with more, you know, vegetables, we've had it up to here with vegetables, you want something a bit more solid, you can get a bit of chicken over in Bodhinyana Monastery because it's not vegetarian over there. So if you really get fed up, you can always go over there and get something to eat. I shouldn't say that, but Bianca's not here, so I think I'm okay. And the etiquette is just be sensitive. Every now and again the monks have a ceremony over there, so don't waltz in there when the monks are having a ceremony and just be quiet. Just be like the thief. You just go in there quietly, sit down, and just so no one can hear you. No other etiquette that I know of. So just be respectful. Dear Ajahn, I seem to go along nicely for a while, then something stresses me out and regresses to old bad habits. Particular in my practice at home, e.g. watching TV as a distraction, lots of it. So I don't want to face my stressed out feelings in meditation. Forget about your home. You're here now. There's no TV. So here you actually practice the meditation. You strengthen the ability to be at peace and to appreciate the peaceful times of your day. And you find when you come on a retreat like this, when you go home, you have developed the skills so that you don't need to go and deal with stress by making more stress in your mind. That's what happens sometimes. People are stressed out and they just make more stress by, you know, doing more sort of extreme things. So instead, when you feel stressed out, you'll learn on this retreat little techniques, just sitting down, just being with the stress, making peace with it, being kind, being gentle, and you find the stress disappears. So the techniques you hear, you learn here, will solve those problems which you experience at home. Dear Ajahn, when I do meditation, after a while I feel my shoulders are tight, my neck is stiff. I think I'm forcing myself. How can I do it properly? If that's happening, try sitting on a chair, because the person who's probably asked this is sitting up on the sitting on the ground. If you sit on a chair, you can lean back and you can relax your shoulders much better, which means that you can do some more meditation on a chair. If you really like sitting on the floor, alternate one session on the floor, one session on a chair. If you still get bad shoulders and bad neck, just go into your room and meditate on your bed, on the back. That's fine. You can get into some deep meditation just laying down. So those are possibilities, but don't keep forcing it because that pain will get worse and worse and worse. it must mean that your posture is a bit tight for you, so I'd encourage you, try a chair. And you can lean back on the chair and you find your neck and shoulders become much more comfortable. Honourable Ajahn Brahm, I have a severe phobia of certain flying insects and spiders, completely irrational but enough to freak me out. Please advise how to overcome this fear so I could let the creatures be. Instead, I feel the urge to get rid of it and in so doing end up breaking my precepts too. At this time, I think there's not that many flying insects. And it's only, you know, it's very rare you can see a spider over here. You know, you have to go looking for one to find one. So it's a pretty, you know, it's well kept, nice and clean. So first of all, don't think about it, don't worry about it. Just do the meditation. Make the mind very peaceful and calm. And once the mind is peaceful and calm, then suddenly, you know, you may be just so peaceful, so happy, and then you see a spider, and then it's no problem anymore. Or a flying insect may come past and think, my goodness, I'm not reacting. Because the stillness and the calm in meditation will overcome that problem temporarily. I remember my teacher telling me that he didn't do, no, not my teacher, my preceptor, he never did much meditation, but he said that when he was a very young monk, he was meditating somewhere in the jungle. When he came out of meditation, there was a venomous snake coiled up in his lap. You know, and these snakes in Thailand, I mean, they are very, very dangerous. And if you move, first thing a snake will do will be bite you. But he said, even though he came out of meditation, right in his lap was coiled up a snake, and he knew how dangerous it was, he had not the slightest bit of fear. He realized this is what happens in meditation. Things you usually are terrified of, it's just a snake, that's all. Because your mind is very peaceful and calm. And soon that snake slithered away, he got up. What surprised him was he had no fear, where usually he would have fear. And the same will happen with your phobia of mosquitoes or spiders. Just don't try and deal with the problem yet. Just get your mind into some deep meditation. Become still and peaceful and happy. And then you'll find you're not afraid. And that will actually start rewiring your brain into overcoming that phobia. So just carry on the meditation. Don't make a big thing about the spiders or anything. And soon you'll be fine. Even when I was in Thailand, I used to have tarantulas. And they would used to walk on the roof. On the ceiling, rather. On the rafters. And sometimes they'd fall off the rafters. And it was so hot, I just had my lower robe on, my chest was totally open. And they'd fall on top of your bare skin. And run off it. And there's so many times that happened. I wasn't at all scared, it was like tickly. That's all. Having a tarantula running over your chest was just, it was actually quite pleasant. I recommend it for you. It was just like tickling, and it was off. It didn't hurt at all. They weren't going to bite you. They were just, you know, having a tour around. Those big spiders, they're fine. So after a while, you find you're not scared at all of these things. It just, the fear just disappears. Try and get rid of the fear, and it gets worse. Just let it be peaceful, be kind, and it disappears. Ajahn, when you get frustrated with the disciples' actions and behavior, do you feel like quitting your job as spiritual teacher and letting them go? You never get frustrated. You just think, just it's good fun. When people do things really, really stupid, then you think, wow, this is really funny. So, number one, you expect people to do stupid things. That's number one. And number two, when they do stupid things, you always see the funny side of it, how stupid people can be. And you usually tell everybody about it, you know, about what they did, and that makes everyone else laugh. But what's the stupid thing which Jagannatha has done? I remember the time, and I'm trying to think now, I better not say. He's bigger than me. Now, we all do stupid things at times, so you don't get frustrated. Frustration is the sign of a control freak. where you really want someone to achieve this and get that. And as a monk, I tell other people not to be a control freak. I'm not a control freak abbot. I'm not a control freak monk. I don't even control my own mind. I let it be, and it's much more peaceful, much more still, much more happy. So you don't do that with monks. You don't get frustrated when monks do stupid things. I did hear that one of the Anagarikas has gone on strike. And instead of getting frustrated, I think that's really funny. You know, what happened? And Anagarika, I don't know what he's going to do. He can go on strike as long as he likes, as long as he doesn't start a union and get all the other Anagarikas to go on strike as well. That will really start worrying me when he joins up with the unions in Perth and makes a chapter of the CFMEU in Bodhinyana Monastery. Then I'll be in trouble. But other than that, it's just funny. So laugh. Don't take it seriously. So I don't get frustrated. Frustrations is a sign of a stupid person. A sign you've had too many expectations. So lower the expectations, you don't get frustrated. And for goodness sake, don't get frustrated about yourself today or the next few days. Have no expectations at all of your meditation. When you have no expectations, you will not get frustrated. For example, I said it's a tradition that the water runs out on these 9-day retreats. So we don't have expectations. You expect to have water when you open up the taps? That's craziness. Just because there's a tap there doesn't mean there's water in it. So if you do get frustrated, it's because you had unrealistic expectations. They just laugh at it and just be filthy for a few days. In regards to how one meditates on the floor or in a chair, I believe it may be a problem of perceptions or image. We all have the image in mind of the Buddha sitting in the lotus position, becoming enlightened under a tree. Also, we rarely see monks or nuns sitting to meditate. Could our mindsets be so conditioned that this is what we perceive as the best or most likely to succeed position of meditation? Yeah, it is, but you know, there are statues of the Buddha sitting on a chair. There are many monks meditate on chairs, like Ajahn Sujato usually meditates on a chair because he's got very bad knees. So when I'm on an aircraft, I meditate on a chair. I do ask if I can meditate cross-legged in the aisle, but they don't let me. So I have to do it on a chair. So I often thought it would be wonderful if we did have a Buddhist airline, so we can do it away with all the chairs and just sit cross-legged on the floor. You'd be able to get twice as many people in the aircraft, because you could have a double layer there, and it'd be very, very simple to sit cross-legged. And I'm surprised that, especially Indian airlines, you expect them to sit cross-legged on the ground instead of having these stupid chairs. And when the meals, they just put a few dishes all in front of the people, and people sit around and they can just help themselves. That'd be much easier for the flight attendants and everybody else. So we should have real Asian airlines instead of these Western stupid things with chairs and your own dishes and stuff. Anyway, so it is, there's an image there, but you know, you overcome that image. And also, don't be stupid. Don't have so much pain. If you really want to learn how to sit on the floor and you're trying to learn that, do yoga, stretching exercises. Then you can learn to sit on the floor. Otherwise, just meditate on a chair sometimes. It's more comfortable. Some other monasteries, oh, here we go, teach enlightenment can only be gained through vipassana. Is this true? How do monks here split their time? Jhana, samadhi, vipassana, metta, or whatever. Oh my goodness, that is so untrue. People are crazy when they say these things. The Buddha said, and I can get the books out if you don't know this already. You can ask the monk sitting next to me, ask the nuns. Every monk who knows what they're talking about, every nun who's done a tiny bit of study, knows the only way to get enlightened is the Eightfold Path. Nothing else. Standard Buddhism taught for 26 centuries. Everybody should know this. It is core teachings, basic Buddhism, Eightfold Path. And Eightfold Path includes keeping your precepts. So you can't just say, no, just be mindful, you become enlightened. No, you have to keep precepts for goodness sake. You also have to have some right view. You also have to have mindfulness and samadhi. The eighth factor, the eightfold path, is called jhana. That is the only way you can become enlightened, according to the very clearly stated many, many times teaching of the Buddha. That's why I had the argument with the greatest Zen teacher over there. I said, look, this is what the Buddha said. Everybody knows this. It's right there in black and white, not just once, hundreds of times. Eightfold path. You need jhanas to become enlightened. So no, we've got the shortcut. Yeah, I know about shortcuts. Have you ever been in a shortcut and got totally lost? I remember the worst shortcut I ever took was when I was teaching in Sri Lanka, and I was teaching in Kandy, and these Sri Lankans, they live in the place, and they did this shortcut from Kandy back to Colombo. And they're halfway, you know, on the main road, it's a busy road, they took this shortcut. We ended up by Kalutara, which is about an hour south of Colombo. A long way. Those Sri Lankans, you'd know what I'm talking about. And everyone else, they got home about 2 hours before we got home. I said, where are you? Where are you? Yeah, we took shortcut. That always happens. So I never take shortcuts, because the reason why the Buddha gave the Eightfold Path, because that is the shortcut. He was a wise, smart guy. If there was a shorter path, he would have told you. If there was a way to avoid all of these difficult things like keeping precepts, he would have told you. If you didn't need jhanas, which, you know, take a lot of time and skill, he would have said a sevenfold path. He was a compassionate being. And he said eightfold path because, my goodness, you do need eight parts to it. And everyone is important. So everybody from all the time, they will say, no, shortcut. Shortcuts are very attractive. Even when I check my emails, there's always a spam file. Investment opportunities. Get rich quick. They even send that to me. I don't know why spam email is sent about, you know, this is quick information, how to become rich very quickly. And people still buy into that. They're absolutely crazy people. The shortest cut to being rich is to work hard. We don't like doing that. No, we want to tell the shortcut. We don't like to work hard. So please, there is no shortcut. So here is eightfold path. It includes jhana. It includes vipassana. It includes metta. It's the whole lot. So don't think there is some shortcut. That is a total myth. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between discipline and control? Where do you draw the line between observing strict discipline versus being control free? So this is a general question, not just for meditation. And this standard answer I give, some people keep complaining, why do you keep telling the same stories? Because you keep asking the same questions, is the answer. And I've had this question many times before, and the answer is from the Chinese Art of War, a general who had the best discipline in all the imperial army. And the emperor summoned him, what is the secret for your discipline? Because your soldiers always follow your orders and they never rebel. Why? What is the secret of your discipline? And the general said, my soldiers always follow my orders because I only ever tell them to do what they want to do. That's why they always follow my orders. I only tell them to do what they already want to do. It's very easy to follow an order when someone tells me, Ajahn Brahm, this is what you should do and I already want to do it. Of course I'll follow that order. But how can you want to get up early in the morning to train? And how can you want to train so hard as soldiers do? How can a soldier want to go into battle knowing they get wounded or even killed? How can they want to do that? And the answer was motivation. That general was such a great motivator that when the bell or the sound went in the morning to get up, those soldiers were so motivated, they're probably already up before the bell. Yes! They really wanted to train. So they never needed to be told to train. They were up there training just extra because they were motivated. When it came into going to battle, they were so motivated by patriotism or heroism or whatever else this guy did, they couldn't wait to be given the order. Go in and fight. They followed orders because they were motivated. That is the secret of discipline. Motivation. To want to do it. So when the order comes, you do it. To motivate yourself, you want to get up early in the morning. I like getting up early in the morning. It's fun getting up early in the morning. So you get disappointed if you sleep in at night. Oh, I missed something. Now that is the secret of discipline. To want to keep the rules. To want to do it. To see the purpose in it. So you are motivated. So on this retreat, there is a sort of timetable, but don't even. The only two times, or maybe three or four times you have to remember, is breakfast, morning talk, lunch, and maybe evening Q&A. The only four times you really need to. And even those, you don't really have to come to my talks. So those are the only four things you have to remember. And do I need to discipline you to go to breakfast and lunch? Do I have to sort of warn you? If you don't go to breakfast again, you'll be in big trouble. I'll never allow you to come on this retreat ever again. You'll be blackballed. You don't need to sort of use a stick to get people to go to breakfast or lunch. Why is that? Because you want to. You're motivated. The same with everything else here. All the talks I'm giving you, I'm brainwashing you, motivating you to want to meditate. So that's where discipline comes from. Motivation. And in your office or your workplace, if you're a manager, or you want to motivate your kids to do well at school, don't use a stick. Don't shout at them. Use other forms of motivation. And then you get the best discipline when people are motivated to do the right thing. Dear Ajahn, over the past 4 years, I've been experiencing panic attacks. I meditate every day, practice yoga and tai chi, and eat healthy, but still, panic attacks happen unexpectedly. I live in fear of them happening again. What are panic attacks? Please advise. Thank you, with metta. Okay, how to overcome panic attacks? Again, another sort of standard story I tell every retreat. Is the lady, Jippy, she had panic attacks in Adelaide University. She was studying dentistry. She had such great panic attacks. She was afraid to get out of her bed, even out of her bedroom. She was in the house for months. Psychologists, doctors couldn't help her. So she called me up because her uncle is a strong supporter of our monastery. I won't tell you who he is, but many of you know him. So she called me, and my first piece of advice was, when you have the panic attacks, where do you feel it in your body? Locate it for me. And she said, I don't know. Give me a call in 3 or 4 days' time when you can tell me where those attacks are located. I gave her something to do. 3 or 4 days later, she gave me a call. She said, just under my chest area. And she could locate it for me. She said, wonderful. Now, describe those panic attacks for me. How does it feel in that area when you have a panic attack? Oh, I can't say. Give me a call in 3 or 4 days' time when you can describe the feeling to me. Again, I was giving her some work to do. I was asking her to be mindful of the physical feeling associated with panic attacks. Three or four days later, she called me again, and I was impressed. This very descriptive explanation, or this very good description of all the feelings associated with a panic attack. She was a highly intelligent girl. And I said, great, now you have become mindful of that feeling enough to describe to someone else exactly what it feels like. So now you've established mindfulness. Now you have to start practicing compassion. So the next time you have a panic attack, next time you feel that sensation coming on, get your own hand and massage that area of your chest. If you can't do it, get your boyfriend to do it, to massage that area. And that's what she did. After 3 or 4 days' time, she called me again, said, yes, I follow your instructions. Every time I feel this panic attack, we massage it. So what happens when you massage that feeling? I said, the feeling disappears. So what about the panic? And that was the light bulb moment when she paused, said the panic went away as well. Exactly. Now you know how to deal with panic attacks. If you react emotionally to panic attacks, it makes it worse. You're not skilled enough to deal with mental stuff. But every panic attack has an associated physical sensation in the body. You become aware of your physical feeling associated with panic, and you've learned how to deal with the physical counterpart of anxiety. You find if you deal with the physical part and relieve that, the emotional part also disappears. So every time she had a panic attack, she'd massage her chest and it would disappear, and the panic would disappear as well. A few weeks later, she was out of hospital, out of sort of her bedroom, back to study. She did, a brilliant girl, got her first class honours in dentistry. She married her boyfriend. I did the ceremony for her a couple of years ago at the Sunken Gardens up in UWA. And she even nominated me for Australian of the Year that year. Of course, I never achieved that accolade, but I was very touched. She said, look, you really saved my life with my panic attacks. And this is just the least I could do to nominate you. And now she's living happily with her husband over in Sydney, sort of as top dentist. No more panic attacks, living a wonderful life. And that's how she dealt with it. So your panic attacks, they do have a physical counterpart to them, feeling in your body. It may not be in your chest for you, it may be somewhere else. Know that feeling. Know that feeling really so well you can explain it in detail to another person. And then you have mindfulness of that sensation. Deal with the sensation, usually by massage, with as much softness and kindness as you possibly can. And then when the physical counterpart goes, so does the emotion. That is what I've also taught psychologists to teach their patients. When I experience a stillness, I hear my heartbeat and it is disturbing. How can I stay away from concentrating on my heartbeat? Stop your heart beating. And then it won't disturb you anymore. So have a heart attack and then you'll be peaceful. Now the heart is disturbing. So how you overcome that, if you start to watch your heartbeat, you can't really get rid of it. And it will never stop because you know, you're going to die if it stops. How you deal with that is learning a trick of focusing. If you focus on me right now, just focus just on my face, and after a while you find the monk sitting on my right disappears. You can't see him anymore. Because it's just the nature of focus. Whatever is in the center of your screen, usually the mind focuses on that and excludes everything to the left and the right. It's the same reason why when you watch a TV set, it does not matter how big the TV is. Because after a while, your mind fits into that TV. Whether it's small or whether it's big, it fits in. So you can't see the edges, you can just see what's happening on inside. So even if you had a triangular TV, it would look exactly the same as an oblong TV. It's just the nature of focusing. So if you can focus, say you're watching your breathing, focus on your breath. Yes, you can notice the heartbeat, but the heartbeat is on the left or the right of your field of attention. It's not centered on the heartbeat. So you just keep watching your breath. Yeah, the heartbeat's over here somewhere, but my breath is at the center. And after a short while, you will not be aware of your heartbeat anymore. You'll only be aware of what's in the center. The same way, if you're focusing on the heartbeat and your breath is on the edge, after a while you don't know what you're breathing. What is the main focus of your attention will eventually dominate and everything else will fall off your screen. It's the nature of paying attention. What do you mean by a still mind? Is it a blank mind? Do we have to meditate at the same time every day? When you are going to start practicing? Thanks. A still mind is a mind which doesn't move. It's not blank. There's always something you can be aware of in your mind, but just the mind isn't moving. It's not agitated. Is the lake blank when there's no waves on the surface? No, it's just still. So it's not blank, it's still. And I'll be saying a lot later on about the still mind and how amazing it is. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do I solve the problem of negative thoughts and distractions in my mind? Even though I'm trying to let go and doing metta meditation, such thoughts will still continue to come up from time to time. If we welcome and be kind to our mind to such thought, what happens if our mind really starts to follow the distraction? Should we try and control our mind? If someone is trying to influence us or is displaying their anger on us, how should we react? Should we be quiet or should we try explaining? Second question first. If it's this retreat, just forget what other people are doing. Be an island unto oneself, as the Buddha said. Just be a refuge unto oneself. Other people can get angry at you, but that's nothing to do with you on this retreat. That's their problem, not yours. If you, once you leave this retreat, then it gets a bit more difficult because so many people are angry out there in the world. And if they project it at you, just let it go. Wash it right over you. Remember, be like a lotus flower. A lotus flower is a symbol of Buddhism because if you urinate, if you piss all over a lotus flower, your urine just falls off it and it leaves no residue. If you urinate on a lotus, it doesn't smell of piss afterwards. It's totally gone. If you pour Chanel No. 5 on top of the lotus, still it all just rolls off the lotus leaf and the lotus smells of lotus, not a smell of Chanel after you poured it on. Because the lotus does not keep any residue. So you imagine yourself like a lotus. People get angry at you, they curse you, they call you all sorts of bad names. The next time people say you're the best monk who's ever lived since the time of the Buddha, you're such a wonderful teacher. Whatever they do, it all falls off and you're still the lotus as you were before. You keep nothing, no residue from the past. If you can practice like a lotus, that's how to deal with people who are angry at you and trying to influence you. They just cannot. But the problem with negative thoughts in your mind, if you are negative to the negative thoughts, it's just called double negativity. And then you get negative to the negativity towards the negative thoughts, and it becomes treble negativity. And it goes on and on and on like that. You get crazy. You've got a negative thought in your mind, just let it be. Welcome negative thoughts. See how negative you can be. See if you can beat the Guinness Book of Records on the worst negative thought ever. I know one of the worst curses which I ever heard, the most negative of negative thoughts, was the famous Middle East curse. I know what it's like in the Middle East, but they're very violent and they also got some of the worst curses in the whole world. And the worst curse, if you really don't like someone in the Middle East, you say to them, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. It's got class anyway, I must admit. May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. But if you have a negative thought like that, just you laugh at it and it's not negative anymore, it's a bit of a joke. So with those thoughts, negative thoughts come up, let them be kind to them, and then you're not making more negativity. And after a while, if you're kind to the negative thoughts, you don't buy into them, you just leave them alone, you laugh at them, and after a while they disappear. I'll tell more about that later on. After a short time of meditation, my breath became very quiet and effortless. It remained like this for 2 to 3 hours. Please enlighten me on this. Thank you very much. You stay for another couple of hours, you'll enlighten yourself. It's wonderful. This is what is supposed to happen. Watching the breath, effortless, peaceful and wonderful, to 2 to 3 hours, you're doing fine. So carry on. And then you have a wonderful time. And I'll say again more about what happens. It just remained like this. Excellent. Keeping 8 precepts, is it okay to use shampoo, conditioner or deodorant? Once the water comes back, yes. But I wouldn't use conditioner and shampoo today. Otherwise it's going to stay on your body and you're going to be in real trouble. Deodorant, yes, please use it. Is meditation self-hypnosis? No, it is not. I do the hypnotism around here. I do the brainwashing. It's not self-hypnosis, it's meditation. Do monks wear underpants under their robes? If so, are there special monk underpants? Shall I show you? Because that's the only way you can really know. We're told in Buddhism, as he was saying, you're not supposed to just believe, you're supposed to check up and see for yourself the Dhamma. That's one of the great traditions of Buddhism. It said, Ahipasiko, Pachatang Weditabo Winyuhi, means to investigate, to come and see, to find out. A wise person should find out for themselves. So the answer is no, we don't wear underpants. That's one of the nice things about becoming a monk. As a man, you felt free at last. Venerable sir, as you said, that not to control the mind. I practice mindfulness while I'm walking or eating. I only concentrate on the movements of my body. Then the unwholesome thoughts arise. As I watch, they subside. As I let them go, they keep arising like a train. Thought out of things. Should I keep watching them or should I just let them go? Thank you. Just let them go. And please, the worst word you can use in this meditation retreat, it's almost like a swear word to me. It's called concentrate. Please don't do that at all. The only concentrate allowed in here is concentrated apple juice or orange juice or something. But concentration has got nothing to do with meditation. It was a bad translation of the word samadhi. It meant stillness. Don't try and concentrate. That's too much force. You never concentrate. I'm concentrating now. The glass of water will never be still, no matter how hard you concentrate. You just get frustrated. Let it go. And then stillness happens. That's a big mistake in meditation. People trying to concentrate. And I'll say more about that later on. Lastly, what is metta? I am a beginner. Ah, that's such a wonderful question. Whoever wrote that is just so kind and lovely. You must be so close to enlightenment, whoever wrote that question. And the way I'm treating you is called metta. It's loving kindness, it's care, it's compassion, it's accepting, it's respect. You have metta to someone, you respect them, you're kind to them. You give them the benefit of the doubt when they sort of snore so loudly in the middle of the night. You have loving kindness towards them. If you do loving kindness towards other people, they're no longer a problem. Do loving kindness towards yourself, then you're no longer a problem to yourself. Loving kindness to every moment, beautiful metta to this moment, and then you're on the highway to enlightenment. So easy. So there we go. There's all the questions tonight. There'll be many more afterwards, but it's actually quite a lot for the first night. Please, the rule is only one question per person per day. So if you put a question in there and you think, I want to ask another one, take the first one out. So only one question per person per day. And by a question, I don't mean part A, part B, part C, part D. So just one question each. Otherwise, it goes on a bit too late. But this is the first night, so I didn't want to go pretty quickly. It's only 9:15, which is really good. If you want to carry on meditating, fine. If you want to just sit around the stupas on the outside, it's a nice cool evening outside. Just sit outside and just watch the lights in the distance or have a look at the stars. If you feel very tired, have a nice rest. So have a nice evening, and we'll see you tomorrow morning sometime. Good night.